That Podcast Thing presents Home Movie Club, originally recorded December 2017. Episode number 19, Defenestration.
Hello and welcome to Home Movie Club, the podcast in which we take an irreverent and sometimes irrelevant look at the highest grossing movies of the last 80 odd years. This time round we are watching Alfred Hitchcock's classic Rear Window from 1954. A film about a murder.
Or is it?
Dun dun dun!
Joining me on this voyage of discovery are Joe Carter.
Yay, hello!
Daisy Swaffer.
Hi!
And as always, my lovely wife, Sammy Kelch.
Good afternoon, slash evening, slash morning, depending on when you're listening to this podcast.
Nighttime, could be listening during the night.
Good night! Sounds more like I am bidding you, it's not really a greeting, is it?
I'm just going to go with salut.
So yes, at whatever time it currently is in wherever you are in the world, or indeed any world, welcome and thank you for listening. This is a film from 1954, so it's probably needless to say there will be spoilers for the film in this here podcast. So if you have yet to watch Rear Window, I would very much encourage you to pause this podcast, go and watch the film at your most earliest convenience, and then come back to us, because this is a film that is definitely worth watching.
Yes.
And really will be spoiled if you listen to us talk about it before watching it.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, that goes with pretty much any of the films we're looking at in this podcast series, but certainly with this one that is a mystery, the mystery is kind of going to be spoiled if you've not watched the film, but listen to us.
Totally spoiling it now. Okay, so everyone that's not seen the movie now, I'm going to give you a little list of instructions. So press stop, watch the movie, press start again, and in 3, 2, 1, we're ready to go.
So yes, let's get everybody's opening thoughts on this film. Let us start with Joe.
Yay, me! Okay, so I actually really enjoyed this film. I really enjoyed, even though I had to watch it twice, but that's fine because the second time I made notes, so now I have a detailed chronology, including lots of key points, including such things as sleep, later, and rain. Also, dog. So I am ready to discuss the heck out of this really good film.
Yep, all of those are very important plot points. and Daisy?
I'm a Hitchcock fan, and this is my favourite Hitchcock movie. I've seen this a lot of times, and yet it never gets old. Whenever I watch it, I still absolutely love it. So I think that says a lot for the film, especially for a mystery, because a lot of times when you watch a mystery, once you know the mystery, it loses something when you watch it again. But it's never lost that with me with this film.
Good. Excellent. And Sammy?
Great news. Daisy's pretty much said everything that I was going to say. It's great. I super love it. Jimmy Stewart is awesome. Grace Kelly is awesome. The whole way that this story and its scene and everything is constructed is so good. That's it. It's great.
And your opening thoughts, Dave?
My opening thoughts. I hadn't seen this film before, so I wasn't quite sure what to expect. Obviously, it's a Hitchcock film, so there are certain conventions you expect to see, such as the director making a cameo, which he does indeed in this. But yes, no, I very much enjoyed it. And I was hooked. It was very good. So let us get into the story.
Speaking of the story, it's based on a short story called It Had to Be Murder. But the short story only featured our main protagonist and the person who they're watching. All of this other stuff was all basically like an idea by Hitchcock to add to the story to make it into a great movie. So although it is based on a short story, a lot of what we love about this film just comes straight from Hitchcock's mind.
Now, can I just say that I absolutely loved finding out that the author of the original story this is based on was named Cornell Woolrich. And I was absolutely devastated to find out that that was a pen name and not his actual name, which was something super boring by comparison.
Aww.
I know!
Also, has said, calling your novel or story, it has to be murder, kind of seems to be giving it away a little bit.
Does a bit, yeah.
Unless there's a question mark on the end, and you can't obviously see that.
That's just what the protagonist is feeling, though. He's feeling like it had to be murder. Like, that's...
Yeah, actually, I agree with Daisy on this one.
The screenwriter that he hired to make it, this was the first screenplay that he hired this particular screenwriter to do for him, but he obviously liked it because he went on to hire the same screenwriter to do To Catch a Thief, The Trouble with Harry, and The Man Who Knew Too Much. So it was a good partnership for him.
That was great.
So the film itself opens on a window, perhaps obviously enough. Camera pans to a shot of a leg in a large, full sort of cast. Here lie the broken bones of L.B. Jeffries, is scrawled on the chalk white plaster. The camera continues to pan around the room, showing striking photos and a very broken camera.
Yes, just a tad squashed, rather like his leg.
So sad. Yes. That was so sad.
But really epic photo of a crashed race car, like, falling apart in front of him. So possibly the shot that caused all the damage.
Yes, I think the owner of the broken camera, and indeed the broken leg, is L.B. Jeff Jeffries.
Interestingly, in the short story it's based on, then it's only on the very last line of the whole story that we find out that our protagonist has a broken leg.
That's kind of harder to mask in a film, I guess. So L.B. Jeff Jeffries, obviously here played by Jimmy James Stewart.
Yay, Jimmy Stewart.
Hey, Jimmy!
Known as Jeff, so that's how I'll refer him to because it's easier to write that in my script than Jeffries, who is obviously broken leg and recuperating during a sweltering New York summer.
Oh, and we know it is hot because one of the first things we see is a thermometer.
Unfortunately, the thermometer is in Fahrenheit.
We have no idea what that means.
But it does then show people being hot. So
yes,
from the thermometer and then the people, then it's like, oh, the thermometer is indicating to us that it is hot. I understand. Yeah.
So as we've alluded, Jeff is a successful photographer known for taking difficult pictures that no one else can get. This includes the one we see of an out-of-control race car, which, as we said, smashed his camera and then his leg an instant after the photo was taken. Jeff lives in a small apartment and spends his time in a wheelchair, leg in the cast, looking out of the rear window into the courtyard of his apartment building.
Hey, you said the name of the movie.
Can we take a moment to, since he's looking out of his rear window into the courtyard and everything below, take a moment to talk about the set?
Yes,
of course.
Let's do that. It's a good set.
Also, when you're mentioning the set, mention the crappy CGI helicopter.
I'm not sure it was CGI, but it was composite.
Yeah, it was a really, really crappy helicopter. And I specifically wrote crappy helicopter as a second line of my notes.
Aww.
So they actually scoped out to see if they could use a real life filming location for this. And there wasn't anywhere that they really found suitable that they could use for it. So they built it, but in order to have the set high enough to have, you know, we've these apartment blocks are quite a few stories high and we've got the courtyard at the bottom. The buildings that they build these sets inside of were not tall enough. So they worked out that if they took out the floor under which furniture was stored, they could gain a whole level that way. So Jeff's apartment is on the ground floor level, and then it's below that, actually down like in the basement where the courtyard actually is. But as a result, the lights at the top were really close to the actors and the crew working at the top there. So they were absolutely sweltering during the filming. And it was so hot, it even set the sprinklers off at one point.
Oh, no.
Pretty.
I mean, one would assume the reason they went to the Sixpence is because it is a Hitchcock film.
Yeah.
And probably a less lauded creator of movies wouldn't get the same treatment.
Yeah. So. And this was a marvel as well. People were like, coming to visit Paramount, like, in order to get a tour of the set whilst it was being filmed, because they'd heard about this. This was, you know, this was a big deal, this set. So really, you know, well worth taking a moment to appreciate it.
So Jeff takes a call from his editor and complains that he has another week in the cast and that he's already endured 6 weeks of being cooped up in his apartment. His editor has a job lined up, and Jeff, so desperate to take it, even with a broken leg, but his editor says he'll have to wait until his leg is healed before he can get back to work. Jeff was talking about actually taking photos while in the back of a wagon or on a horse or something. He's reached the point where he's been trapped in his apartment for so long that any chance of getting out and doing something is sort of stir crazy, to the point where, you know, he is just losing it a little bit.
And we've seen from the photos what kind of lifestyle he must have been living to be out there taking these very varied and far away photos. So
it's very obvious that he's not someone who would easily take to being cooped up. He's not the cooping type.
Yeah.
Can I just interject that the exact phrase was from a Jeep or the back of a buffalo?
It was a buffalo, wasn't it? I did think, that's like, okay.
The only reason I wanted to interject that was because that amused me greatly.
Absolutely,
such a great line. That's such a great, he gets, like, they just, this movie just has some amazing lines in it, I think.
The character of Jeff has a very dry sense of humour, and I think Jimmy Stewart delivers those kind of lines very, very well.
He's absolutely perfect for this role. I love Jimmy.
Me too.
I'm sorry, I just really love Jimmy.
I do too.
He's so great.
He's the best.
From the vista of the apartment's window, he can see into the lives of all of his neighbours, catching glimpses of their daily routines, watching them eat, clean, sleep, and argue. There's the girl who exercises in her underwear, the married couple with a small dog that lives on the top floor apartment, and who sleep on their small balcony fire escape to beat the heat. Then there's the older lady who lives alone and craves company above all else.
Aww.
Jeff nicknames Miss Lonely Hearts.
Miss Lonely Hearts, we love her.
There's also the struggling songwriter, always working his piano, trying to find just the right melody. Across the way, we see a pair of newlyweds take tenancy in their new apartment. They come in, they say thank you to the superintendent, and they walk out again. And then he carries her over the threshold. And then there's the salesman and his bedridden wife, who live directly across the courtyard from Jeff. Jeff can see clearly into that apartment, and they seem to bicker and argue a lot. Every day, a therapist, Stella, from the insurance company, comes to visit Jeff, feeding and cleaning for him.
Yay,
while
Stella.
Dispensing her mature wisdom, berating him for simply sitting there all day and spying on his neighbours.
She injects a lot of what the humour element that this film needs to stop it kind of dragging down a bit. Stella is absolutely really well cast.
Yeah, she's got a very
really
sort
well
of
written.
Very New York accent as well.
Yeah.
So. Stella, who's played by Thelma Ritter, tells him that he should get his mind off his neighbours and think about marrying that beautiful girlfriend of his.
Which is
and
fair.
That is in commas, yep.
But of course he says that he's not ready for marriage, and that even if he was, he couldn't marry Lisa because she was just too perfect.
Too perfect. Yep. He manages
she's
to make
too
perfect
girl.
Sound like an insult, which is quite remarkable.
Yep.
So she's rich, successful, a socialite, whereas Jeff lives the life of a war correspondent, always on the go, usually living out of his suitcase and often in unpleasant environments. It's not the life he wants to offer her.
And understandably, he just can't see how they could make a life together when their lives are so very, very different.
Yeah, but Stella retorts that that girl is packed with love for you right down to her fingertips.
Yeah, I think what he's failing to take into account is that it should be a decision that they make together rather than he just makes for the two of them.
Yes indeed.
Yes.
The young lady in question arrives shortly after Stella leaves. Lisa Carol Fremont.
Grace Kelly.
By Grace Kelly. Yay. Breezes in wearing a stunning satin dress, looking every inch the beautiful socialite that she is, but obviously very much in love with Jeff.
And we are all in love with her.
As Lisa and Jeff talk, they engage in more neighbour watching. Miss Lonely Hearts has a table set out for two and a candle lit, but she simply pretends to have a companion. She's that alone.
That's so sad.
It is.
See, this is why the internet's great. Because if they had the internet back then, she could just, you know, hang out with people on the internet.
She'd have been on Tinder. She'd have had a date. It'd have been fine.
Exactly. Yeah. She'd just, you know, be swiping and yeah. she'd meet somebody nice in her neighborhood and they'd go out and have spaghetti and...
Well, she might meet someone eventually.
I hope she does.
The ballet dancer, who Jeff calls Miss Torso, is entertaining a crowd of men. However, Jeff's eyes go back to the salesman and his bedridden wife. Jeff sees the salesman carry food to his wife in bed, and then after a few cutting words, he leaves her alone to eat it. However, after he moves to the other room, he makes a phone call. Hearing this, his wife sneaks out of bed and confronts him. We see the songwriter at his piano again, with the obligatory Hitchcock cameo. Yay. As the director stands winding the clock next to the piano.
That's really cool.
That was nice.
Jeff and Lisa stop to have dinner, specially arranged by Lisa, and delivered by a local restaurant, 21.
Holy heck, she loves this boy so much. That was such a romantic gesture.
Get someone from the restaurant to actually cook a full meal and bring it up to them in his apartment.
She wanted to have a romantic restaurant meal, and so she made it happen. This was obviously something the restaurant didn't usually do. And she got them to do it because she wanted to have a romantic restaurant meal with him, and she knew that he couldn't go out to do that with her. So, she provided for him.
She did, and then he rained all over her parade because he was just gloomy, and then they end up having an argument.
Yeah. He's a big old grumpy guts.
Soon enough, the conversation turns to their future, and they begin to disagree.
Aww.
Lisa wants to help Jeff make his career in the city, but Jeff is dedicated to his more nomadic lifestyle. As they argue, Jeff complains that he sees no way of them reconciling their different lifestyles.
She says she just wants to be part of his life somehow. And that
I haven't got to that bit yet. Hang on.
Sorry.
Lisa walks sadly to the door, putting her gloves on and making to leave. Lisa confesses that she is in love with Jeff and that she just wants to be part of Jeff's life somehow.
Aww.
As she leaves, she says goodbye, since she can see no way of them having a possible future together. "When will I see you again?" asked Jeff, worriedly. "Not for a long time," she replies sadly, pausing before saying, "at least not until tomorrow night."
Because he's bedridden and she can't really leave him alone because that would be
she
cruel.
She loves him, and that's, you know, as much as she feels like for her own sanity's sake, she should just forget about him and move on. She knows in her heart that she can't because she's in love with him.
She's so nice.
And I do wonder what their dynamic was like before he broke his leg. Because at the moment, he's in such a miserable and gloomy place. And this obviously isn't the LB Jeffries that she fell in love with.
I do wonder whether he was, when he wasn't in a wheelchair, he was probably also not around that much either.
Yeah.
So they didn't see an awful lot of each other. So what they did see, they kind of made up for lost time sort of thing.
Yeah, I think they probably found it was quite dynamic and exciting and kind of fleeting meals and whatnot.
The night drags by, but it's too hot for Jeff to sleep. It starts to rain as Jeff dozes, sitting in his wheelchair, stationed at his usual spot by the window.
No. You see, I missed this the first time I watched it. After Lisa leaves and he's sort of drifting off, before it starts raining, there's a scream and a crash. And I'm assuming that's coming from the salesman's apartment, but I missed that the first time I watched
it. Yeah, there is.
Yeah,
right.
I think I missed that as well.
Yeah, there is.
And I specifically made note of it because I went, ooh, that's when that happens. But that happens before it starts raining, while he's sort of dozing, so he obviously didn't hear it.
Yeah.
But you do hear, the first thing you hear as it moves into night from evening is a scream and a crash. Then it starts raining, and then you get all the wonderful things that happen after that.
Jeff wakes to the sound of rain outside and notices activity across the yard. The couple, who have been sleeping on their top floor balcony, rush to move their bedding inside, almost working against each other in their haste.
Fun fact about this one.
Daisy's fun fact.
So Hitchcock directed the whole movie from LB Jeffries' apartment, because that was where we were seeing the viewpoint of everything from. But of course, he wanted to give direction to all of the actors in all of the other apartments still. So they all had little flesh-coloured earpieces in so that he could give them direction, but they couldn't talk back to him. And that the couple that were sleeping on the balcony there, he got one of them to take their earpiece out and gave the other one directions for what to do. Then told the other one, put the earpiece back in, and the other one took the earpiece out, and he gave them opposing directions for what to do. So at this point, when the rain starts, the couple there are tugging and pulling because he's told one of them to take it through the left window and one of them to take it through the right window. So they're having this real, actual, genuine tussle with each other, which is how so one of them cheeky. Then ends up flying through the window so on top of cool. the mattress. And they used so that cheeky. Very first take of it because they knew it would never be as genuine as that again.
Yeah, that was absolutely brilliant.
Very, very clever way of manipulating people that Alfred Hitchcock had.
That is such good direction.
The salesman is seen going out into the rain carrying his silver sample case. Jeff looks at his watch.
1:55
And it is 1:55 a.m. Later, the salesman returns. It's now 2:35 a.m.
So he's been gone for 40 minutes in the middle of the night and a raining
in
night.
In the rain.
Pouring rain.
And it's certainly not going out making sales at that time. Nope. So what was he doing?
Well, I mean, what could you be selling at 2 o'clock in the morning? Flashlights?
Umbrellas, probably.
Umbrellas, yes.
Umbrellas with added flashlights. Around the same time, the piano player stumbles home, clearly very drunk. He swipes his musical notation from the top of the piano before slumping down into the chair. Elsewhere, we see Miss Torso having to slam her door closed to keep one of her suitors out. Twice more, the salesman goes out into the rain in the middle of the night, lugging the silver case before returning some time later. Intrigued, Jeff wonders what the salesman is doing, but he finally dozes off around daybreak. Whilst Jeff sleeps, we see the salesman and his wife, leave the apartment.
You see the salesman and a woman?
And a woman, yeah.
Yes, we see the salesman and who we assume is his wife leave the apartment. Morning comes and Jeff discusses the incident with Stella.
So we see this as the audience.
But he doesn't.
See Jeff sleeping. We pan to him sleeping after we've just seen the salesman and a woman leaving the apartment. So suddenly we've got this piece of information that Jeff doesn't have, which gives a lot of power to the audience. You know, like we're following along this story as Jeff Rees is, and then suddenly we've got this quite crucial bit of information that he doesn't have, and I think that's a really clever thing to do. It really sucks the audience in to you're suddenly more invested in the story because you've got this extra bit of information.
Yeah, indeed.
Because you know that when he starts worrying about where the wife is, you're sort of thinking, well, we saw them leave.
Yeah, exactly. He didn't, we know that he didn't see them leave, so that's why he doesn't realise that what we saw was them leaving. Yeah.
So morning comes and Jeff discusses the incident with Stella.
Morning comes and the cute little doggy gets let down in a basket so it can go run around.
Yep.
That's the first thing that happens.
Which is important.
Morning comes and we see the couple from the top floor apartment lower their dog down in the basket, allowing it to wander around and do its business. Jeff discusses the incident of the salesman with Stella and they both begin to watch. With the blinds now open, they can see that the wife is no longer in the apartment.
Well, no, the blinds, the shades are open. He opens the shades, but the wife's room is still, the shades are still closed at that point.
Yep.
Because he goes, well, I couldn't see anything because the shades are down. And Stella looks out and goes, he's opening them now. But the ones in her wife's room are still closed, which is important. And he is looking, I've put in inverted commas, out of the window. And Jeff goes, that is the look of someone that is checking to see that he is not being watched. And then the dog starts digging in the flower bed.
He's a good boy.
Morning comes and the couple in the top floor apartment lower their dog down to the courtyard for it to do its business. Jeff discusses the incident with Stella and comments that the blinds are still closed, although when Stella looks, we see that the blinds are now opening. Although the blinds in the wife's room are still closed, the salesman can be seen cleaning the inside of his sample case. Jeff pulls out his binoculars and then a large telephoto lens to get a better look.
Yeah, well, he asks Stella to get the binoculars and then he sort of starts looking out of the window. Then he realizes that people could see him, so he wheels back And then he sort of looks through the binoculars, looks at the binoculars, and I'm thinking, oh, he's thinking, this is wrong. I shouldn't be doing this. But no. Then he opens a cupboard and pulls out a telephoto lens for his camera.
If you bear in mind as well, though, his entire career is observing and photographing. He's used to being a voyeur on things throughout, everywhere he goes. So to him, it doesn't feel strange. It doesn't feel wrong. Because that's just what he's used to doing.
It's his job.
But there's a difference between him doing that and this, which is definitely.
Oh, there is.
As Stella said when she came in the first time, it's a crime. Peeping Tom is a crime.
Yeah, I can understand why he doesn't really. Feel much of a difference with it.
Yeah, no, I can too. It's just I was thinking because I was just thinking when I was watching it, I was like, oh yeah, he feels weird about... No, he doesn't feel weird about the binoculars. The binoculars just aren't good enough.
Yep.
He needs the incredibly long telephoto lens attached to his camera.
Which is also what he's more comfortable looking out of. Yeah.
Yeah, and this whole theory and this whole idea of whether this, what he's doing is right or wrong is certainly touched on later on. Yeah. But I don't think it ever gets to a point where Jeff is like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this?
No.
Maybe a little bit later on, but not a lot. He doesn't seem to have an awful lot of self-doubt when it comes to this.
No. It's just I just thought that it was an interesting portrayal of this particular scene where it's like, ooh, maybe I'm doing something wrong. Oh, maybe not.
Maybe I'm just not doing it well enough.
Yeah.
So through the telephoto lens, they watch the salesman go into the kitchen and they see him clean a large knife and a saw
before
wrapping both in an old newspaper.
Yeah, that's really, really creepy.
So he's just been cleaning the inside of his case and then putting the things he usually sells back into the case. And now he's wrapping up a giant... Yeah. Like, that was not any old knife. That was massive. And this saw in paper. Like, this is looking pretty dodgy.
There's nothing unsuspicious about that, let's be real.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not a butcher and there's no sign... anywhere else in the apartment as to what he would have been doing with these things. So although we've seen him leaving with a perfectly healthy looking woman, we are with Jeffreys going, what? No, there's something dodgy going on here, but it's just not necessarily what he thinks it is.
Yeah, it's starting to feel a bit off.
Yeah.
But then, Jeff's tired because he's been up all night, so he snoozes off there.
It's nighttime again and Lisa is back in Jeff's apartment.
Can I take a moment to talk about the lights?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So we've already mentioned that they had this massive set inside the Paramount Studios building and the lighting setup for this was pretty tremendous. And changing the lighting for the set would have taken a great deal of time all the time for all these different, we're changing day, night, morning, afternoon, all these things. But what they did was actually quite clever. They set it up for four different times of day. They had morning, early afternoon, late afternoon, kind of early evening and nighttime. And they just... It wasn't quite as easy as flipping a switch, but it was. It still took about 45 minutes to do the changeover. But they had these four distinct settings of times of day, and then they just changed the lighting between these four already predefined setups. So that's why you only ever get four different times of day. But it meant that they could pack in the filming so much easier that way without having to constantly change and adjust and tweak the lighting setup, which I think was, at the time, that was pretty innovative.
I think that's really clever because it also made it really easy to tell.
Yeah.
Sort of like first day, second day, evening, night, that sort of thing. You could tell the time progression.
Yeah.
Which when you're in this sort of thing and the timeline is so important as to who knows what when, it's nice to be able to tell when it's changing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we are now in nighttime.
On day
Lisa
two.
Is back in Jeff's apartment. They discuss the salesman, but Lisa says there's no way that someone would do a murder or anything like that with all the windows and curtains open.
Before that, the basket's lowered down to bring the little dog back up.
The little puppy.
Because it's nighttime now. So that little dog's been down in that garden all day, presumably.
Yeah. Well, not necessarily just in the garden. It might have wandered off to do it in a while.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. So yeah, it's now that it's nighttime, the little basket gets lowered down to bring the dog back up to their apartment.
The salesman is seen returning to his apartment with a coil of rope. Lisa chastised Jeff for being nosy and doesn't believe the salesman murdered his wife. However, when the salesman is seen tying a large packing crate with rope, she becomes convinced something is afoot and asks Jeff to tell her everything.
Lisa does, before they see that, she does chastise him for looking at his neighbours with binoculars.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I did appreciate her having that moral compass.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And it does, at that point, you know, where we are being sucked in the same way that Jeff is. And when she chastises him for looking at the neighbours with binoculars, it feels like we're being chastised because we're being just as voyeuristic as he is. We're watching the same things as him and we're going through this same puzzling the mystery as he is.
Yeah, so we totally want to know what's
happening. It does feel like
you're
being told off by her as well, and you can't argue with it. It's like, yeah, you're right, but I'm going to keep watching.
Yeah.
You're going to feel guilty about it, but yeah, totally.
So as Lisa leaves for the evening, she checks the name on the front of the building. It is a salesman's name is Lars Thornwald, played by Raymond Burr.
She also has, before she does leave the apartment, she reasons with Jeff saying that if he had murdered his wife, then he wouldn't have the windows uncovered now. Like, he would be hiding things, not having his windows uncovered. So she's trying to provide an alternate viewpoint, some reason to it, and it's giving us some reasoned view at the same time.
Yeah, and Jeff counters with saying, well, you know, invalid wife that needs taking care of is in bed all the time. No one has been into the room the entire day and the drapes have been closed. So that's his counter to that. It's like, well, something fishy is really seriously going on because he didn't see anyone leave except for the salesman. So,
and it's only when she sees the box, the big packing crate tied with rope that she actually goes, oh, okay, maybe there is something in this.
This is slightly dodgy. What is going on with this packing crate? And that's when she decides that she's obviously going to go and check the name on the mailbox. And it's 125 West 9th Street. I wrote that down for some reason.
Which, you know, fair enough for our skepticism. You don't want to believe that someone in your boyfriend's neighborhood's just done a murder.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
You really don't.
Fair enough.
And in the old kind of Occam's razor way of things, then, you know, the most likely explanation surely isn't murder whenever you see anything that might look a bit suspicious. So, yeah.
If you hear hoofbeats, think horse, not zebra.
Exactly.
Mm, yes.
The simplest explanation is usually the
exactly.
Best.
Yeah.
But in this case, you know, the salesman's now sitting in the dark smoking a cigar and just looking completely dodgy.
But at the same time, we saw this woman leave perfectly fine. So
which is
the information we have, Jeffries doesn't have. And so he hasn't been able to convey to Lisa or Stella either. So we also have to remember this extra piece of information we have. So whenever we're hearing these kind of doubts, you know, things that Lisa says to go, oh, but, you know, surely he wouldn't. And then we're going, and we saw the woman leaving. So surely this is all just nonsense. This is just his imagination running wild. And although it looks dodgy.
At least he doesn't say, don't call me Shirley.
Following morning and Stella's back serving Jeff breakfast and discussing the grisly task of cutting up the body.
She's so blasé about it, isn't she? She's just matter of fact.
As you do. Oh yes, but before that, he rings Doyle.
Jeffrey calls in an old army friend, Thomas Doyle, played by Wendell Corey, who is now a detective, and explains the situation to him, asking him to come round. Stella comes in and again starts serving Jeff breakfast, discussing the grisly task of cutting up a body.
Whilst he's eating poached eggs on
the floor.
Because that's the only place he could have done it. It must have been the bathtub. And she's just, that's, you know.
Yeah, it's just totally.
Matter of fact.
Yep.
She's amazing.
She is
also
fabulous.
But the reaction as what she says, and he's trying to eat and drink, and he's just like, "Oh, right, that's no, I'm not bothering now. That's just it. I can't eat eggs and drink tea while she's talking about cutting up a person into pieces. This is just too disturbing."
This is the lovely humor that the Stella character injects.
Oh yeah, she's brilliant,
and she's still like quite, you know, she's crucial to the plot because she's still giving ideas and reasoning and help and things, but she provides this levity at the same time, but it doesn't make her character any less for being a more of a comical character. So I think she's really well
written. I don't really see her as a comical character. I mean, I know she adds levity to it, but she's very matter of fact, sort of practical, sort of as a contrast to Lisa, but they both sort of compliment Jeff's character in a really, really nice way.
Yeah, they do, yeah.
And I think, you know, those two are really the stars of the show.
So they watch as a couple of moving men come to collect the packing crate. Stella runs around the front of the building to catch the name of the moving company, but misses the truck.
So close. We see the truck go by too fast for us to read the side. and then Stella arrives and she just missed the truck down the road. And it's like, ah.
I totally missed the truck going by, but yeah.
It was a green truck with white writing on it. I think I kind of caught roughly what it said, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was something generic like moving truck or something. It wasn't of any use.
But it could have been a lead that they could have followed, but they don't get the information, so that's that lead gone.
Yeah. And I suspect the whole point of it was that we didn't know what it was, so they weren't going to write "the murder done it" on the side of the truck just in case someone did. Blink at the right point and actually see it.
Disposes our road.
And then you've also got the newlyweds at this point. The blind's been down for 2 days, and the guy pokes his head out to get some fresh air, and then you hear the wife from the bedroom
Harry,
and it's just hilarious.
I love him so much. That is exactly what marriage is like. Right, sweetheart?
Doyle visits and speaks to Jeff about the alleged murder.
But first, the salesman makes a long-distance phone call. Then Doyle comes over.
Yes. Later.
The long-distance phone calls are somehow important. I don't know why, but I wrote them down.
They are important.
Yes, they are important. I think because of the whole, well, for later on, spoiler, you know, if she sends a postcard, why is he making a phone call to
her? Yes, indeed. Jeff goes back to watching the apartment and sees the salesman make a phone call. From the numbers being dialed, he can discern that this is a long-distance phone call, although obviously he doesn't know to where.
Yeah, presumably it's the number of numbers that get dialed, which goes to show that the level of detail that Jeff is stalking him with right now to be counting the amount of numbers he's dialing.
Yeah, dude has gone off the rails at this point.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you're going to invest in, you know, investigating what the nuts your obviously suspicious neighbor is up to, you're going to go all in. Otherwise, you know, what's the point?
Well, I mean, at this point as well, he feels like he's fighting for justice. He's like, I've seen this murder, no one else has, and I need to, you know, I'm the person gathering the evidence. So, he's being very diligent.
There's a responsibility there for being thorough and
it's just,
you know,
super
being able
creepy.
majorly creepy.
So later in the afternoon, Doyle visits and speaks to Jeff about the alleged murder. Mm. Naturally, Doyle doesn't believe a word of it.
Oh, dude, is so not convinced.
Well, now
tells Jeff to stick to photography.
Now we're hearing what Jeff has seen through the ears of a police detective, and there is no evidence in the slightest. He hasn't seen any harm come to anyone. All he's seen is just very circumstantial stuff with no evidence a crime has been committed in the slightest. And at this point, as the audience, you check yourself and go,
Wait a second.
Yeah, we're overreacting here, aren't we?
Bored?
Yeah, there's a little bit of paranoia.
Yeah.
A little bit of this guy's been cooped up for 6 weeks and
not
3 days by this point.
Yeah.
And he's obviously lost it, and he's making up stories to pass the time. And he was asleep, half asleep at the time, and it was hot, and he must have been seeing things.
He's clearly just bored.
Nevertheless, out of his friendship for Jeff, he agrees to look into it.
Which is really cool of him.
He's a nice boy.
Find out what, if anything, has happened to Mrs. Thirlwall.
And I don't know about you, but it, as an audience member at that point, I know certainly the first time I watched this, I thought he was just fobbing him off when he said will look into it. I didn't think he actually would look into it, but he does.
Yeah, but then, because then you see him scoping out the apartment when the salesman is shooing the dog away from the flowers because the dog is digging again, which is, it brings attention back to the suspicious flower bed and, why is the dog digging, et cetera, et cetera.
Suspicious flower bed.
Yeah, the flower bed was looking very suspicious. Yep. I gave it a side eye.
Yep. Those flowers were looking at me funny, I can tell you that for sure.
Indeed.
Yeah, I mean, they were all wonky and everything.
Yeah, they were. Yep.
After further checking, Dool reports that Mrs. Anna Thirlwall was seen by several witnesses leaving the apartment at around 6 a.m. Mm. while Jeff was conveniently asleep. There were several witnesses that saw Anna Thirlwall leave the apartment, and apparently she is in the country. And indeed has sent a postcard to her husband to say that she's arrived safely and she's fine.
So this is the one bit of information we had that Jeff didn't have. Jeff now knows what we know, which is that she left with him that morning while he was sleeping.
Yeah.
Now we're back on an even keel with Jeff.
But he doesn't, Doyle doesn't say about the telegram until after Jeff suggests that he could, like, illegally search the apartment to find the evidence, because just because somebody left doesn't mean that it was her, doesn't mean that she got on the train, doesn't mean et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And then as Doyle is leaving, he turns around and goes, oh, yeah, by the way, there was a telegram sent from Anna Thirlwall, and Jeff's like, oh, that's the wife, isn't it?
Yes, because Jeff wants Doyle to search.
Doyle really likes to hold back his evidence so that he can give it in a kind of gotcha way, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's like, oh, I've had all these ideas and I think you should search the apartment. It's like, dude, I can't get a warrant. This is like, there's nothing here. Well, you don't have to do it legally. It's like, oh, that's his job.
That's like police cops 101.
I get the impression the two of them sort of have a sort of almost competitive relationship as well.
Yeah, I feel like there's some life debts in there. You know, someone saved someone's life. Well,
they were
both,
they were pilot and photographer in a reconnaissance air unit. So yes, there probably was quite a few things went between them.
So once we've heard about the postcard being sent from the country saying that the wife arrived okay, then I don't know about you, but as an audience member at that point, you feel a bit silly for thinking that this murder thing was possible.
I think Jeff is beginning to doubt that he's seeing what he thinks he's seen.
Mm. Yeah, and then it becomes nighttime.
Once again, the dog is lowered into the courtyard. Jeff sees Miss Lonelyhearts getting ready for a date, drinking heavily before heading out to a late-night diner across the road. And the piano player is entertaining a couple of women. Jeff sees Thirlwall arrive with his laundry in a box.
You can tell it's his laundry in a box because the box says laundry on it. And then he opens it up and it's got shirts in it.
All folded really nicely as well. Like wrapped
properly
in
laundered,
ribbon.
Yeah. Jeff sees him starting to pack a suitcase with his clothes. Thirlwall then picks up a handbag from the bedside table before retiring to the sitting room.
Jeff calls Doyle at that point because he's like, dude's packing, he's going to run. Sorry. This is a very confusing film.
It's not that confusing as you're watching it, in fairness. I wasn't confused at all.
Oh, okay. It's not confusing when you're watching it, but it's confusing when you're trying to explain it in the order that we got the information.
It's a very complicated plot.
Yeah, it's very good.
Can we take this moment to talk about that, actually? So the screenwriting process for this is basically, this is how Hitchcock liked to do his screenplays. He basically told the screenwriter what he wanted. And then so the screenwriter took the short story, took Hitchcock's ideas, created these characters and this story and everything, and came back with you know, this is my screenplay. Hitchcock then, in the way he usually did with these scripts, but he never took writing credit for them. He would break down each of these scenes into literally camera shot by camera shot.
Storyboarding,
but in a script. So when they actually came to film, they wouldn't be having to do loads of different things that they'd be filming that would end up on the cutting room floor. This was just like a very little editing actually needed to be done to his films because he already had it perfectly written, shot for shot, exactly what everything was going to be. So the screenwriter for this said that, so far as he was concerned, Hitch was a dream to work with, which certainly wasn't the view of a lot of the actors who he worked with.
Or especially the two that had the tug of war over the mattress and then went tumbling. Yeah. But, oh no, that's so incredibly organised. I appreciate organisation like that.
Yeah, I mean, he was a man that knew exactly what he wanted. He knew exactly what his vision of what it was going to be was. And that was part of why he was so great, you know. He had very detailed ways of knowing exactly what the best way of showing things was.
But it's great that he not only knew what he wanted and how he wanted it to look, but obviously it came out that way.
Yeah.
And which is incredibly, I mean, that part is the skill.
Jeff sees Thorwood packing, so calls Doyle to say that Thorwood looks like he's getting ready to leave. Doyle is not in, so Jeff asks Doyle to come round as soon as possible.
At this point, as the audience, then I feel like, yeah, he's packing, but we already know that his wife is in the country, so he's probably packing to go and visit her. But then... Yeah.
But then, yes, then we get the crucial bit of evidence. Yeah.
Thorwood then picks up a handbag from the table before retiring to the sitting room, making another long-distance phone call and going through the jewellery in the handbag.
Yeah, now this doesn't this doesn't look normal.
No, this is not normal. Especially when he picks out several rings, including what is clearly a wedding ring.
Lisa arrives and is fully wrapped up in the mystery of the missing wife because she simply cannot believe a woman would leave her jewellery when travelling.
Yeah, exactly.
And she wouldn't leave her handbag in the closet either is something that she specifies.
Yeah, she wouldn't leave her favourite handbag. She wouldn't have her jewellery all tangled up inside to get scratched. And she most definitely wouldn't go anywhere without the wedding.
And it's Lisa that says that the woman that was seen must not have been his wife.
Yep, she is sure the woman seen leaving early in the morning was not the wife.
And that's something we don't know at all because we never saw the wife clearly enough at the start or when that woman was leaving to know.
Well, when the woman left, she had a big black coat and a big black hat on and we didn't really see her anything from her except from behind. So it could have been any. It might even not have been a woman. We couldn't really tell from the distance.
Yeah. But this is when her feminine intuition comes into play and she specifically sort of says this, I think. Yeah.
Indeed. Lisa informs Jeff that she's staying the night and shows off a tiny overnight case.
She shows off the most awesome overnight case.
That's amazing.
So everything is very well packed.
How did she pack all that in there?
I want one.
Because she's a magician.
She is a magician. She's just perfect. Grace Kelly was just perfect.
And when I say I want one of those, I mean I want a Grace Kelly.
Yes.
An overnight case containing a slinky outfit and a nice little pair of slippers.
Slinky outfit? It was a night dress.
Was it? Okay, fair enough.
The costume designer for the film, she designed all of the costumes that we saw everyone wearing through this. And so she was given the task, obviously, of designing this night dress for Grace Kelly, for Lisa. And Hitch apparently said that he wanted some padding in there because she didn't look curvy enough.
What?
Well, the costume designer and Grace Kelly, neither of them wanted her to be padded. So she just kind of tweaked the outfit a bit and Hitch was none the wiser that she hadn't been padded. So
nice.
bit more flattering lines and things and he thought that what he wanted had been done.
Well, no, because you don't need padding.
Exactly. And that's what the women were going, it doesn't need padding. So she looked beautiful in that nightdress.
She did. Well, we don't see her in it yet, but she does look stunning.
Lisa goes off to make drinks and Doyle arrives and confirms that the packing case full of Miss Thorwald's clothes was collected by the same person who sent the postcard, Anna Thorwald.
No, he doesn't know that until he gets a phone call about it.
Doyle arrives. Lisa is humming in the kitchen. He gives Jeff a look. Lisa comes out and tells him that she definitely thinks that the salesman is guilty. The phone then rings for Doyle. Jeff mentions the jewelry. Doyle doesn't believe either of them. He's checked the railroad. The salesman bought a ticket. He dismisses Lisa's feminine intuition, and which I wrote sexist pig and underlined it 3 times.
Yeah, Lisa's insight, he declares to be feminine intuition stuff, which he says is rubbish.
Yeah, he's very dismissive.
Yeah.
Doyle arrives and Lisa, out making drinks, singing in the kitchen, comes through and tells Doyle about the jewelry. But Doyle, being perfect gentleman, dismisses Lisa's insight as just feminine intuition stuff.
At what point does he get the phone call? It's just after he arrives, isn't it?
Yeah, I've written that Lisa's singing. She tells him sales manager is guilty. Then it says phone rings for Doyle, and then it says mentions jewellery. So I think you'd be safe just after mentioning the jewellery, and Doyle doesn't believe to say that he got a phone call. I think that's close enough in timeline that it wouldn't matter.
Yeah, because he doesn't regale what was on the phone call until he's leaving.
Yeah, until after they've gone through all their theory again.
Whilst Lisa is off making drinks, Doyle arrives. Lisa comes through and tries to convince him that the salesman is indeed guilty. There's a phone call and Doyle takes it, which I thought was a bit odd because, this is not Doyle's apartment. And yes, he arranged for a phone call to be made, but that could have been anybody. That could have been Jeff's mum. We don't know.
No, because Jeff answers it and then hands it to Doyle.
Yeah.
Yes, I guess that. Yeah.
It wasn't just that Doyle picked up Jeff's phone. Jeff did answer it and then passed it over to Doyle. He's not going to give him his mum.
Hello, it's your mum.
Oh, my mum wants to talk to you, Doyle. She's got a word down.
You're in trouble now. Yep, Jeff gets a phone call, passes the phone to Doyle, who responds to the call but doesn't say what it's about. They try and convince Doyle that there is a problem because they tell him about the jewellery that Thorwald was seen sort of examining and looking through, and that, according to Lisa, there's no way the wife would leave without her jewellery. However, Doyle dismisses Lisa's feminine intuition because he's a sexist pig.
Dismisses Lisa's insight as being feminine intuition stuff. Because he's a sexist pig, which he says is rubbish. But it's insight, not feminine intuition. It's using what knowledge she has and applying it. It's not intuition. Mm-hmm.
It's not intuition at all. It is absolutely knowledge. She's smart.
Yeah. Doyle goes to leave before going, saying that the packing case was actually full of Mrs. Thorwald's clothes and was collected by the same person who sent the postcard, Anna Thorwald. Doyle leaves, washing his hands of the case.
Having been absolutely zero help, because...
Absolutely.
Jeff and us, and Lisa, are still convinced that there's something dodgy going on because we believe Lisa's insight.
Yeah, we are not dismissing insight. That.
Yeah, we are not
we
dismissive.
We know that looked really dodgy, and that it's just the fact that the trunk contained clothes, it doesn't rule out what we've seen.
True, although as we've said before, if we look at it purely from the point of view of the policeman, although he's a bit of a dick about it, actually there isn't really any case there still anyway. Yeah. There's still no evidence.
It's still very circumstantial stuff with no evidence of without anything to tell us that a crime is actually being committed other than our intuition.
This is where we get the sort of the ethics debate. Is it wrong to spy on someone even if we prove that they're innocent? And that, I think that's when Jeff and Lisa again start to doubt whether they...
I mean, what we do know about Thorwald is that he is a seller of costume jewellery and of jewellery. So, you know, the fact that he had these what looked like wedding rings and things in the purse. I mean, yes, they suspectedly weren't costume jewellery, but you don't know.
Yeah,
that might have just been stuff he's looking to sell.
Yep. Yeah, that is fair enough. It's an odd place to store it, but, you know, that is a plausible explanation.
Sure.
They do have the ethics debate at that point.
Yes, because Miss Lonely Hearts returns with her date.
Yeah, and they make a comment about how she's too young for him, and I'm just looking at the two of them going,
he's too young for her. Yes.
But then the guy gets pretty forceful with her and she kicks him out.
Yeah, tries force her and she kicks him out before breaking down in tears.
Poor woman.
Poor thing.
Yes. And this is what triggers the fact that they chastise the thought that they're actually intruding on everybody's lives.
Yes.
They see her sorrow and think, well, actually,
that's not a moment
what they're
that
doing.
Want people to see. Yeah.
No, they're being very ghoulish and even a little disappointed when they find out that there wasn't a murder after all.
Lisa actually closes the blinds to the rear window at that point before she goes and puts on
her
nightdress.
Yes, that is very significant. Yeah. I didn't write that down. But then I wrote later. She's wearing very lovely nightwear with a smiley face.
Yep. So Jeff and Lisa settle down for an evening alone, but soon there's a scream piercing the courtyard.
Another scream! Oh no, what could have happened?
They look out of the window and they see that the little dog is dead. Its neck's broken.
The little dog was adorable.
The artist neighbour clambers over and says, "His neck's broken, how could you?" And then there's like lots of wailing and gnashing of teeth.
All of the residents rush to see what the fuss is, except for Thorwald, who sits quietly in the dark, smoking his cigarette.
Which Jeff notices and says, "Oh, this is not normal behaviour. This is suspicious again." And they're back on with the dead dog.
This kind of refires them.
Yelling out to everyone. She's accusing the entire block, you know, everyone who we've been spying on and leading these very, very separate lives. Suddenly, this is the one moment where everyone's drawn into the same thing. And she's accusing everyone of having done this, because how could you have let this happen? You know, even if it wasn't you personally that did it.
Well, we didn't see it.
No, we didn't. But but she's, you know, this is the first time that everyone is suddenly connected by something.
We'd have stopped it if we saw
it. And I think that's a really interesting moment in the film, that one moment where everyone's suddenly connected.
Yeah, it's very raw.
It is, because, you know, we're there wondering about what's happened to this woman, but we don't know whether or not anything has actually happened. Meanwhile, this crime has actually happened.
Yes,
right under
the dog
our nose.
Is dead.
Terrible thing ever, because it's a dog and they're just full of love and they want to be our friends.
It's the evening after the dog was found dead and Stella is back and Lisa is still there. Jeff notices a change in Thorwood's small flower garden in the courtyard.
Oh, no. He's washing the bathroom walls first, and then they start talking about blood and stuff, and it's kind of ghoulish.
Yeah. It's the evening after the dog was found dead, and Stella is back, and Lisa is still there. They watch Thorwood clean the bath and the bathroom walls, Stella being ghoulish and talking about blood and splatters.
Yeah. She's amazing. She is. But yeah, they've been waiting all day basically spying to see him do something suspicious, which at this point they are really crossing the line, but you can almost justify it because they know something's happened.
Well, the fact that everybody came out when that dog was found except for him sat there in the dark smoking was just it's just such circumstantial evidence, but you just know that he must have been the one that did it because of that. So they're just desperately waiting to catch him now.
Suspicious.
Yeah. I mean, no one could have slept, even me, through the scream and the shouting and the wailing and gnashing of teeth.
Jeff notices a change in Thorwald's small flower garden in the courtyard. Using a convenient photo slide he had taken about 2 weeks before, he discovers that the flowers the dog had been digging were now a few inches shorter. Jeff suspects that Thorwood had buried something there and had dug it up after murdering the dog.
He must have been so bored to have taken a photo just of the courtyard.
Well, yeah. Seriously. And then I don't know how he got it processed because,
maybe
you know, he's not going
to
be able to pop down to the local...
It was a negative in a slide.
But it still needs to get processed. So
yeah, you still
perhaps
need
Lisa
to
took it away with
the,
him.
The film. She probably took it someplace, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
or maybe he has a dark room in the bathroom or something.
Sure, I'll develop your negatives of the courtyard outside, darling, whilst you're wheelchair bound because I love you. And these things are totally unappreciated by him.
And then, of course, Stella starts being ghoulish again, saying, "Oh, well, you know, it's not a big enough hole to have buried a body unless she was buried feet first. Yeah. So, yeah, she must have been cut up and the body parts would be scattered everywhere and, you know, somewhere like in the East River.
I love her so much.
Something in the flower beds." And it's just like, this is both really, really, really creepy that you know this, and also, yes, that's exactly what must have happened.
Lisa volunteers to go and dig it up. This is a very big change for her then. You know, this is taking her from being just as passive as Jeff, other than that one time when she checked the name on the door, which is a very, you know, quite removed thing to do, to going, I will go over to where we are certain he murdered a creature for doing this thing and go and do that exact thing. It's like, whoa, those are big steps.
It's infectious,
there.
This adventuring spirit, isn't it?
Yeah, she's like all in now.
Yeah. You see her in quite a different light with just her her suggesting that she goes to do that.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, they were talking about calling Doyle, but, you know, decided not to do it yet. And then they see the salesman starting to pack. And then Jeff writes this really creepy note.
Yeah.
And Lisa goes and sticks it under the door.
Yeah, convinced that Thorwald is guilty. And I say he's packing again. To see what reaction they get, Lisa runs round to the apartment block, to the corridor outside Thorwald's door, and slips a letter under the door asking, "What have you done with her?" in slightly scrawled handwriting.
Yeah.
And she gets away. Lisa delivers the note just in time.
And slips away before Thorwald can find her.
And there's a little bit of a cat and mouse hide and seek type situation where Jeff is looking worriedly out of the window with Stella, and Lisa is sort of hiding the other side of a door, and then when he comes back, it's like going, then slipping out. It's
so
just, it's nail-bitingly intense.
This but then
so
while
stressful,
this is happening, like Stella notices something a bit not quite right with Miss Lonely.
Oh, yeah, this is brilliant. This is brilliant. Well, I mean, not in a good way, but it's amazing that she notices this because,
Yeah, Stella borrows the binoculars and notices that Miss Lonely Hearts has laid out a pile of pills on her table.
Mm.
She recognises the pills as being sleeping pills.
Yeah, barbiturates or something, I think. Basically sleeping pills.
And comments that the amount that are there were enough to you know,
send a whole village to sleep.
Yeah. There's bad number of pills out.
Yeah.
Lisa returns to the apartment with a look of excitement on her face that is matched by Jeff's as he has a look of excitement and admiration on his face, realizing that Lisa is actually pretty much a courageous woman.
Yeah.
And very likely could accompany him on his adventurous life.
Yes. He's like, oh, she is perfect, but now she's not too perfect. Yes. She's just about the right amount perfect.
She's just the right kind of perfect, yeah.
Yeah. So she's reevaluating, or rather he is reevaluating their life together. Yeah. Thorwald is back to packing, and Jeff notices that some of the jewellery Thorwald has looks to be his wife's wedding ring, which she would never leave behind. They decide they need to get into the apartment to gain the evidence to prove the murder happened.
Well, it's the women who are determined to go in there.
Yes.
And so as a result, Jeff works out a way to actually for that to happen. But it's the two of them that are going, no, we're going to go and do it.
Yeah, we're going to go dig in the flower bed. We're going to go and find this evidence.
Yeah.
And so he looks in the yellow pages and gets the number.
So yes, Jeff calls Thorwald's apartment and asks if he got the note.
Yes.
And then tells Thorwald to meet him at a bar down the street, just as a pretext of getting him out of the apartment.
To settle the estate of your late wife. Which, if his wife was alive, he would surely have responded with some kind of, what are you talking about? My wife is fine in such and such a place, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
So they see Thorwald leave, and Lisa and Stella run down to the courtyard, grab a shovel from, I assume, a utility place. They don't have a shovel in the apartment, oddly enough, and start digging in the flower beds. But after a few minutes, they find nothing.
Yes, at this point, Jeff rings Doyle again.
So, Jeff rings Doyle. The detective's not there. We then see that Miss Lonely Hearts can be seen writing a letter.
And Jeff thinks, oh, well, Stella was wrong. And I'm thinking, no, that's a suicide note.
Yeah, that Stella is definitely right. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
However, refusing to give up, Lisa climbs the fire escape to Thorwald's apartment, squeezes in through an open window, much to Jeff's alarm.
Yeah, this is incredibly brave of her because the sort of the fire
brave or stupid, I'm not sure, but
I'm gonna go with brave, because the fire escape or whatever it is she's climbing up is like the living room, and she goes into the bedroom window, which has nothing underneath it.
Yeah, she does sort of hang and swing, and it was a fairly acrobatic move.
Yeah,
but
and I'm assuming this was like the before stunt people, so Grace Kelly in heels doing that is pretty damn impressive.
Yep. What a flipping champ.
Lisa finds the handbag, but it is now empty. No. Stella returns to Jeff's apartment and tells him to ring the phone in Thorwald's apartment as a warning as soon as Thorwald is seen returning.
But Stella sees Miss Lonelyhearts and says that he has to call the police about her.
Yes, yep. Right
Stella
now.
Because sees what's happening and, yeah. So they go to call the police, but then the sound of the musician's music
the piano man.
Drifts through the air and makes Lonelyhearts reconsider.
He's finally nailed that composition.
He has. He's got the melody just right. And it affects Mrs. Lonelyhearts, Miss Lonelyhearts, to the point where she reconsiders.
Captures her heart. And it's this beautiful connection across apartments that you would never have foreseen happening. I love that moment.
Yeah, that was incredible because she'd reached her limit, you know, and that amount of human connection, that just a little bit of human connection made her go, oh my God, that is so beautiful. And then, she reconsiders.
Mm. I mean, a lot of the music in this film is done via the medium of the piano in that room.
Including the thumping.
It's ambient sort of within the scene and the characters hear it as opposed to being superimposed by the musical score.
Which is very clever.
It's very effective, I think.
I agree.
Rummaging around the apartment, Lisa finds Mrs. Thorwald's wedding ring.
But we see that Thorwald is back.
And as Jeff happened to, quite by happenstance, ring the police, he then tells them that there's a woman being attacked in 125 West 9th Street because he's not able to ring the apartment to let Lisa know that she's about to be walked in on. And Lisa sort of hears the door and goes and hides, I think, in the bathroom or the bedroom.
Lisa's entrapped. Stella and Jeff watch helplessly as she tries to hide, but is found by Thorwald moments later.
Yeah, which that's a bit terrifying.
And he grabs her.
They see her try and talk her way out.
She's calling out, though. She starts calling out for Jeff, which means that Thorwald then knows that there's someone else in on this called Jeff.
Yes. Yep. And then he turns the light off and it's terrifying. And Stella and Jeff are sort of clutching at each other and then the police arrive and it's just like this
The police got there remarkably quickly.
Burst of
like I don't
tension.
Know how fast the 1954 police were to respond in this area of New York, but man, they were fast to arrive there.
Hopefully they were just down the street because it's the first time they arrived that quickly, but it's not the last.
It's certainly lucky for Lisa that they arrived that quickly because we don't know what would have happened to her otherwise.
Yeah.
Jeff watches across the courtyard as the police question Lisa and then arrest her. Her back is to him and he can see her hands behind her back pointing to Thorwald's wedding ring, which is now on her finger.
Thorwald sees her
Thorwald sees
that
this as well.
And follows where she was pointing to and sees Jeff over there looking at him.
Who then scoots back too late.
Yes.
Pulling back into the dark, Jeff calls his detective friend, who agrees to get Lisa out of jail.
Mm, but no, before that, Stella, they do the whole money thing and Stella offers to go bail her out. Then he rings Doyle because he's alone at that point.
Okay, I have that the other way around, but fair enough.
Well, no, it's important because once he rings them, he's then alone and he starts... He basically... Because then the phone rings again after he's hung up with Doyle.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then it's like, creepy, 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 creepy! I don't like it.
Pulling back into the dark to hide, Stella and Jeff go through money they have and try and find bail. Stella takes the cash and heads for the police station. Jeff calls his detective friend, who agrees to get Lisa out of jail, and is now convinced that Thorwald is guilty of something.
Hang on, Doyle might have actually rung, because I've put phone exclamation mark, which I think means that the phone rang and it was Doyle.
Yeah, Doyle calls back is what I put.
Yeah,
so Doyle
calls back.
Him.
Ah, okay. Pulling back into the dark, Stella and Jeff go through their appropriate wallets and handbags to get together the cash needed for bail, and Stella heads to the police station. The phone rings. It's Doyle. Who agrees to help get Lisa out of jail and is now convinced that Thorwald is at least guilty of something.
Because Jeff tells him about the ring and the dog, the dead dog.
Yeah. Jeff is left alone and looking back into Thorwald's apartment, he sees that all the lights are off. The phone rings and Jeff answers, assuming it's Doyle. He quickly says that Thorwald seems to have left. But with silence on the other line, Jeff realises that he has been tricked by Thorwald and Jeff is now in danger. Dun, dun, dun.
Yep, and he's just there in his wheelchair, broken leg,
pretty helpless.
All on his own. and the dude knows where he lives.
So down below, he hears the door to his apartment building slam shut, and then slow footsteps beginning to climb
the
stairs.
Oh my god, so slow!
Footsteps. And then the hallway light outside of his apartment turns off, and then footsteps again, and oh my god! The tension that Hitchcock is so good at creating.
Oh my god, at this point I was just like, I need to make notes, but it's like, I've written, oh no! Many exclamation points!
He can only find, as a weapon, his flash gun for his camera. But the flash gun looks to be a Gravlex, I think it's called, which is basically the handle of which was used to make Luke Skywalker's original lightsaber in Star Wars.
So he totally grabs for a lightsaber to defend himself.
He pretty much grabs a lightsaber to defend himself.
He absolutely paused the film and went back and double-checked again when we were watching it, because that was cool.
Love it.
Yes.
Yep. But as I say, at this point, he only has it as a flashbulb, not as a lightsaber. A lightsaber, rather. Under the door, he watches the hall lights go off, footsteps stop outside his door, and then it slowly opens.
He at this point, has backed away to the window, and I think he's pretending to be asleep. At least that's the impression I got with the flashbulbs in his mouth.
Trying to just,
he's just trying to blend in with the dark apartment.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he's trying
but
to
chameleon
himself into the shadow.
Then that door opens, and silhouetted, we see Thorwald, and it's just, God!
Thorwald stands in the dark looking at Jeffreys. Who are you? He says. What do you want from me? Jeff does not answer, but as Thorwald comes to him, he sets off the flash gun, temporarily blinding Thorwald for a few seconds. And we see that with a sort of an orange effect on the screen as he...
Yeah, the eyes recovering. That was very clever.
From Thorwald's point of view there, he's saying that Lisa could have turned him in because the police were there and Lisa obviously had
why didn't they?
So from his point of view, he's like, she could have turned me in, so what do you want? And we're going, that's a good point, but we already knew that the police had dismissed the case, so...
But also he was like, well, how do I get my ring back as well?
Yeah, because he knows that's evidence.
Yeah, because he knows it's evidence. And then, Jeff is just basically lots and lots of flash bulbs.
So Thorwald is blinded but not stopped. Jeff keeps stepping off flash bulbs in Thorwald's face, but he finally fumbles his way to Jeff's wheelchair.
I've got a fun fact about that. So you know how they did, for the very first time in the whole movie, we see something that's not from the point of view of either Jeffreys or just being in Jeffreys' apartment. We get the point of view of Thorwald after he's been blinded by the lights. And that there's like an orange circle we get across the camera.
Yeah.
To decide what effect they were going to use for this, they got a bunch of people who worked on the film, put them in a room and kept flashing flashbulbs at them. To get them to say what they saw.
Wow.
It just
that
seems
is suffering
really
for your art.
Quite cruel. Yeah. But
that seems
quite
like
accurate.
A health and safety issue
Yes. I love it.
Thorwald finally fumbles his way to Jeff's wheelchair and grabs him and pushes him towards the open window. Fighting to stay alive, Jeff cannot stop Thorwald and is pushed out, hanging onto the ledge, yelling for help.
This is really interesting to me because this is the point at which our protagonist is now confronting the antagonist, and his only weapon against him was these flashbulbs, and all he was able to do was delay him. He had no means of fighting him off at all. Delay was his only weapon, and it was futile. And I think that's really like... You know, normally our hero of the movie, you would expect to, you know, fight off the bad guy. But no, all he is able to do is delay him. And I think that's really fascinating.
It's really poignant.
Yeah.
Mm. Especially because he sort of starts yelling out for Lisa and Doyle. And they're going to Thorwald's apartment, and they spot him hanging out of the window. And it's like, oh my God.
So, Jeff is pushed out the window. He's hanging onto the ledge, yelling for help. But there's also police at Jeff's apartment as well, and they all rush in and
Sorry, I missed that. Because I was like, I knew that Doyle and Lisa had gone over to the salesman's apartment, because I assumed Doyle had bailed her out.
Yeah.
And then they'd gone to get the evidence. But I didn't realise the police had also gone to Jeff's apartment, because I was like, how did they get up there so quick?
Yeah, no, I think they went sort of two for one, two for the other, just to, I guess, to make sure that Jeff was all right.
Which is very, very prescient of
them. He wasn't.
Indeed. Yeah. Thorwald is pulled back, but it's too late. Jeff slips and falls just as the policemen run up beneath him. Luckily, they break his fall, and Lisa sweeps him up into her arms.
Aww.
Thorwald confesses to the murder of his wife, and the police take him away, which, you know, he kind of canaried very easily at that point.
He should have held out, going, it's all circumstantial. But I think
they're planting maybe evidence on me. That wedding ring, that wasn't there. The girl planted it in my apartment.
But it was a convenient, neat way of ending it.
Yeah, we are reaching the end of the film, so obviously they wanted to not turn it into a courtroom drama. So.
Oh, yeah, but the best thing is that when Doyle comes over to Jeff to find out how he is, Thorwald's been singing like a canary. They were like, oh, he's taking us to the East River. And Jeff was like, what was in the garden? I was like, well, there's a hat box in his flat now, in his apartment now, containing what was in the garden. Do you want to see it? And Stella goes, nah, it's okay.
Yeah, for once she's now like, actually, no.
Even Stella doesn't
decomposed body parts. Yeah, we don't want to see that.
We can just imagine. It was blatantly her head.
It's a few days later and the heat has finally lifted.
Yay.
The camera pans across the other apartments and there's sort of an entail for each one.
Which is really
nice. Miss Lonely Hearts has hooked up with a musician, which is nice, and they both seem to have found themselves. Whilst the newlyweds both look to have come to an abrupt end to their honeymoon period.
Yes, because Harry has quit his job, and they're like, and the wife is like, well, why did we bother getting married if you were going to quit your job?
Yeah, doesn't she say, I'm not sure I would have married you if you'd have told me
that exactly. Yeah.
Like, oh, harsh.
Yeah. A couple on the top floor are now training a new puppy.
They have a new puppy.
And they have a new puppy.
Miss Torso has a short army man.
Yes,
Miss Torso's husband finally arrives. A short, respectable man in an army uniform who Miss Torso clearly loves greatly.
And his name is Stanley.
Because I think the part in this one is that despite the fact that she is in many ways equally as perfect as Lisa, she's not settled for second best. She's settled for actually someone she really loves.
Yes, which is
and that kind
so
of shows
clear
to Jeff that actually this is fair for him as well. So that the rest of the neighborhood just gets on with their lives pretty much.
Yeah, but the one of the neighbors is asleep and the artist is painting something, and then it pans through the rear window and poor Jeff is now sitting in his wheelchair. Two broken legs, the poor guy. Yeah. He was so close to getting out of his
sight. He was two or three days away, and now he's...
Yeah. Except that now Lisa is there wearing very simple clothes and reading a book about the Himalayas. When she sees that he's asleep, she gets her Bazaar magazine out, which means that she's not compromising on who she is. She's still staying true
brilliant.
To herself.
Yes.
Yep.
But she wants to come on an adventure with him.
She's going to change her life for him, but she's not going to give up her passions.
Yeah, she's not going to lose herself in that sort of relationship. Yeah. And hopefully she'll temper him a little bit so he won't go, you know, falling out windows.
It's all about balance of compromise, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's
a good compromise.
That's one of the pillars of a good relationship, is the balance of compromise.
Because there's nothing worse than the movie's ending. It's like, oh yes, and the woman has to give up everything for the love of the man, blah, blah, blah. And this was a really nice ending.
Yes,
well,
and that
aside
ending
from the
was
two broken legs, obviously.
Another 6 or 7 weeks in a wheelchair,
At least.
But at least now he seems to have Lisa to look after him as well.
Yeah.
So yes, that is indeed the end of the film.
And then it says the end.
Yep,
it does.
It does
and
say
we get
the
nice
end.
Very nice music and the credits roll.
I'm just looking down at my fun facts that I haven't covered while we've been recording.
We need more
this.
Fun facts. That's a very important part of the podcast.
Yeah, well, I've only got one left.
Oh, perfect.
And that's just, I watched a documentary that was on the DVD along with this. Hitchcock's daughter, Georgina Darcy, was talking a lot about not only making this movie, but, you know, her dad's filmmaking in general. And she talked about the casting for this, particularly about Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly. And I thought it was quite interesting, so I thought I'd regale. She said that her dad hired Jimmy Stewart a lot. He does appear in quite a few of the Hitchcock movies because he felt that Jimmy Stewart represented the ordinary man. Not sure. I've never met anyone quite like Jimmy Stewart in my day-to-day life, but I like that that was what he was going for in his casting. And and when he cast Grace Kelly, she said that Hitchcock saw her as the epitome of the cool blonde with the fire underneath. And I think that's a wonderful way to describe Grace Kelly.
That is a rather epic description.
Lovely.
That is Rear Window, one of Hitchcock's classics.
Body count on screen was zero, but in actual fact was two, Thorwald's wife and the dog.
Yes, we didn't see anyone die, but we did see a dead dog.
Yep.
Which, again, I like the effectiveness of making use of the things that you don't see.
Yes.
And I think Hitchcock is so good at that in this movie.
Yeah, I think, well, you could say that the casualties of the movie was another one of Jeff's legs and the puppy and the wife.
Yeah, but his leg will get better, whereas the dog is...
Yeah, the dog is definitely dead, yes.
On a farm upstate.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so let's do some final thoughts. And in a twist to our normal schedule, I'm going to go first. Because I can. I like the film. There was much about this film that I really liked, but there was just one small point that really bugged me the entire way through the film. And that was simply, if Jeff had learned to lock his door, none of this would happen.
Well, it wasn't so much that he didn't lock his door, it's that Stella rushed out to go and bail Lisa out of the police station and... I guess didn't lock the door behind because she doesn't have a key.
But that wasn't the only time it happened. Doyle came in a couple of times without being let in. Lisa just wandered in, although theoretically she might
have
a key.
Maybe normally he locks the door, but when he's stuck in a wheelchair, then it's a lot easier
than
getting
into the
door.
Stairs to get into the apartment from the door, so that's kind of an impediment for him.
But it just annoyed me that...
A thing of the times, because just... somewhat tangentially, but this reminded me of it. There was a neighborhood in Manchester where I used to go to the leisure center because it was quite a poor neighborhood, and therefore the council had funneled tons and tons of money into giving it like the nicest leisure center in the greater Manchester area. But there were also a lot of people in this neighborhood who had lived there since, you know, probably around the time that this movie was made. And so they had to put notices up all over the place, like, don't forget to lock your doors.
Aww.
Because back in the day, people didn't as much, you know?
Yeah.
I know, like, my grandparents' generation, you know, didn't really, you know, they just, if they were in the house, they'd just leave the door unlocked and it was just fine.
Growing up, that was the case for me in my Yorkshire village, yeah.
Actually, I do agree, Dave, because that was my first thought. I was like, why hasn't he locked the door? He can hear someone coming up. I would lock the door. I mean, totally Thorwald's going to kick it down, but it would delay him a little bit more.
Yeah, there were steps up there. He couldn't get it.
Oh, to the door? Wow.
Yeah,
literally,
you
had to go
steps.
Down like two or three steps to get from the front door into
that,
the flat.
That building was not handicap accessible.
No, they didn't really build them with that.
And I suspect, actually thinking about it, it probably was designed specifically for that purpose, to stop him going locking the door.
So that he couldn't go and block the door, exactly.
But the rest of your final thoughts, Dave?
That's pretty much it. I mean, I really enjoyed the film. I hadn't seen it before, and I wasn't 100% sure what I was expecting, but it was very, very good. And yeah, I don't know, would I watch it again? Yes. Would I rush to watch it again? Possibly not, but simply because I think having watched it once, watching it a second time would have a different impact, because it's one of those films where you know what happens.
If
you know what happens, it's a different film almost. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I will watch it again, just maybe not straight away. So, but no, I enjoyed it. It was good. Daisy, your final thoughts?
Absolutely. Well, I already said how much I love this. What I really like about this film is how we are voyeuring on Jeff's life and his romance, whilst he voyeurs on everyone else's lives in his little block. If I was going to teach a masterclass on the way that Hitchcock would get us into the mind of a main character, I would use this film for that. Just the way that he cuts things, he would show us the character, in this case largely Jeff, then he'd show us what Jeff was looking at. Then we cut back to Jeff and see Jeff's reaction to that. And it was a really just fantastic way of putting us exactly in the mind of what that character is seeing and feeling exactly. And that's crucial to this film, I think. And yeah, this film is all about voyeurism and it's just done brilliantly.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Joe, final thoughts?
Well, I'm going to agree with you on the watching it a second time changes how you see it, because I did do that because I wanted to make notes. And knowing what was going to happen, yet still it was still incredibly enjoyable watching it. I really thoroughly enjoyed it even a second time. And it was sort of nice to see how, as Daisy's mentioned previously, like all the little elements go together in the order, and we see some things before Jeff does, and we have... Yeah, we're spying on him, spying on them. It's just a really incredibly well crafted film.
Yeah,
and yeah,
I
would heartily recommend it. I didn't know what to expect. I had thought I'd watched a remake, but as the end was completely different to what I remembered, I'm going to go with that wasn't what I watched, because I'm fairly certain what I watched may have also been the remake, but I may have also watched something where in the end it was actually the dude doing the watching that did the killing.
Oh.
And there was no window. And I really don't know what it is that I watched.
I have no idea what you
Because I looked
watched.
Up the remake and it's got Christopher Reeve in. And it was after he was paraplegic in his wheelchair. And I was like, well, yeah, but I don't think it was Christopher Reeve that killed anyone. So I honestly don't know what I watched. If any listeners... know what the heck I watched that ended up with the dude who was doing the watching actually have done the killing, and he was remembering something and there was no window, then please do write in and let us know.
Yeah, that sounds like
confused,
a completely different film. But
I did really enjoy it, and I think I enjoyed it more the second time because I knew what to expect at the end.
Fair enough. And Sammy, your final thoughts, please.
Hello. Yes, I still really like this movie. I've kind of gone over some of the reasons why I really like this movie, but I continue to do so, and I've definitely seen it a couple of times, and I will definitely watch it again, probably. So, there you go. And also, Jimmy Stewart is great.
Yes, he is, indeed. Okay, so that was Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window. Next time round, we will be watching another classic, although not of the same variety. As next time round, it is Empire Strikes Back, the second in the original Star Wars trilogy. Until then, I would like to thank you all for listening. I'd like to thank my fellow podcasters. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Thank you, Daisy.
Thank you.
And thank you, Sammy.
Why, thank you so very much.
So until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Home Movie Club, part of the That Podcast Thing Network. Visit us at www.thatpodcastthing.co.uk. where you can find links to all our social media, including Twitter, Facebook, and our new YouTube channel. Please like and subscribe for news of our future episodes coming soon.
So, that was Alfred Hitchcock. No, we can't wrap it up.